listening to The Job, a talk show about design, music, business, culture, songs recorded in the 70s, movies made in 1984, and Portland, featuring interesting interviews with interesting people, and brought to you by Need More Designs. My name is Ray Briglib. I'm joined by Dan Manchester today. Hi, Dan.
Hi, Ray.
Today is Monday, March 4th, 2013, and this is episode number 3. You know what they say? It's a magic number.
Okay.
Stay tuned for an interview with Martin Leeper of indie music legends, The Minders. But first, let's just talk about what's going on this week. Dan, I think you have a correction.
I have a correction?
From episode 1.
Well, it's not a correction. It's just I thought I was wrong.
Oh.
I corrected myself.
Okay.
Internally.
So the lead... Now, tell us what it is.
Well, I had mentioned... We were talking about the Google Chrome developer tools, and we were talking about why they're so much better than others. And I mentioned that,
Safari.
Well, they're better than everything at this point.
Okay.
Yes, they are. And I'd mentioned, like, they, you know, they have a team of great people working on it. And I mentioned that the lead developer of Firebug was working on it. And then I wasn't sure if that was true after the fact. And I looked into it. And I think he's since left. And that's what I saw. But he was, in fact, working on the Google DevTools team starting in the summer of 2011, I believe.
So specifically, like, the team working on the little...
Yep, on the
inspector
developer
thing.
Tools, yeah. And everything that happens there.
There you go, folks.
So many things.
Dan was right.
And that's really all that matters.
That's a theme.
Mm-hmm.
A theme here. Yeah, I'm concerned about our future robot overlords.
Also a theme.
It's been a very depressing weekend for me. I could only stop the crushing pain of realization that future generations were doomed to be dominated by artificial intelligence that we released into the biosphere by watching Cannonball Run 2, the sequel to 1980s Cannonball Run. And that worked. That helped. It made my weekend better. And I should also mention that I have two daughters, and the oldest brought home a toy called Chickener that is sent home from the school, which you're supposed to write in a journal and bring to exotic locations. So we brought, you know, we went to the zoo, which is about as exotic as you can get in Portland, literally. And, you know, I considered photoshopping Chickener on, like, you know, the moon landing or something, but I'm not going to have time for that. On that note, I have a great interview with Martin today. The Minders were a band that came out of the Elephant Six Collective in Colorado, but, long ago, they moved to Portland and recorded a number of indie albums that were very good. But it's been 7 years since they've put out an album, and they're working on a new one now that should come out this year. So I sat down with Martin the other night to talk about his personal history, his thoughts on music, and, as you will find out, how much good music was recorded before electronics or even possibly electricity. So, without further ado, let's talk to Martin Leeper of The Minders. There it is. All right.
We're on. Rolling. Yes.
Okay. So, I will have, to set the stage, I will have already introduced you. In the podcast. So then there'll be like this, you know, 10-second snippet of applause.
Right.
That I'll sort of lay in there. And then...
Cool.
Hi, Martin.
Hello. Hey, Ray.
How are you?
I'm good.
Excellent. For people who might be listening to this podcast, who don't know you, what do you do?
What do I do professionally or creatively or?
Yes.
In my professional life, I roast coffee, but in my former professional life, and I guess semi-professional today, I play music, and I write songs, and have done so for nearly 30 years now, and pop songs. Pop is my prime interest. But yeah, songwriter, I suppose I could call myself that after writing about maybe, I don't know, 100 songs or something. And that's about it. I play rhythm guitar. I like to record a lot. I'm mostly interested in writing and recording. But
Where are you from? I notice you don't seem to have a West Coast accent.
I'm originally from Portsmouth, England.
Okay.
It's on the south coast of England.
Okay.
But I came to the States in 1984, and I have been here almost 30 years now.
Why did you come to the States?
My dad.
Okay.
His job, he was a electronic engineer. He's retired now, but worked for Digital Equipment, DEC, in the mid-80s. And he came over here on business trips and really enjoyed it and brought us along and...
That's funny. My dad worked for Digital as well.
Did your dad work for Digital? No way.
In the '80s, yeah.
That's crazy.
They know each other.
My dad was a senior engineer. He was in storage systems.
Okay. Yeah.
Semiconductors, that kind of stuff.
I don't know exactly what my dad did, but it was something to do with computers because he was always bringing computer equipment home. But
yep.
And then we moved to Minnesota when I was young because he moved to 3M. But so we were moved because of the not quite as dramatic a move from Ohio to Minnesota as maybe from Portsmouth to.
Well, we'd moved to Germany before we came here, so we'd lived in Germany before, and we'd moved about. You know, his job kind of. You know, I'm sure you remember probably from your dad that, you know, electronics is a fairly competitive field, and especially the kind of electronics my dad was involved in. And so he was always constantly moving from one company to the next. And yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, mine as well. Electronics were different then. It was like everyone had their own sort of systems. Like I think 3M like made their own computers and stuff. It's like...
Right.
I'm sure they don't do that kind of thing anymore.
No.
Not since like...
Yeah, my dad having a digital computer.
Yeah, exactly. Yep.
And before that he worked for National Semiconductor before he worked for Digital, and he worked for IBM before National Semiconductor.
Okay.
And before that he worked for Marconi's, which was... an old British firm no longer exists. And before that, he worked for the Ministry of Defense.
So very competitive
business. MOD.
Yeah. So when you say you've been writing music, do you say for 30 years or just playing music?
Yeah, writing. I mean, I started writing songs in 1985.
Okay.
So 28 years.
What was... the first time you ever recorded a song, what did you record on? What kind of? Was it like a handheld?
The very thing, first time I ever.
Yeah.
You know, I had.
You discovered the magic of recording yourself.
Yeah, no, and that would have been before 85. That was when we still lived in Germany. I had two, you remember those handheld tape recorders, the ones with the handle pulled out?
Oh, yes, I do.
I had two of those.
I totally wish I still had one of those.
What I would do is bounce from one to the other.
Yep.
Did the
with
same
my guitar, and it was really basic. And then when my first band was called The Procession, and in 85, and we went into a local recording studio, and the guy had a half-inch 16 track, which I thought that was great, but I mean, half-inch 16 track is not so hot.
Right.
You know,
right.
I learned that later on with purchasing my own equipment and stuff. But yeah, so started with a tape deck or two, a couple of tape decks. Then I graduated to my own four track a lot later, really. I was kind of a little slow to get to that point. And some friends of mine that were heavily involved in recording in the early 90s, they had sort of warmed to recording, home recording, much quicker, and they sort of learned the tricks of the trade really quickly and sort of had several years to kind of experiment. Whereas when I got into it in the mid-90s, as far as recording my own stuff, I had a lot of catch-up work, so, mm-hmm. yeah.
So did you... Is this all self-taught, everything that you do in terms of recording, self-taught?
Today it is, yeah. I mean, yeah, the stuff that... I mean, my band, The Minders, the first singles that we recorded... The first single we recorded was with Robert from the Apples, for Apples and Stereo, Robert Schneider, and he did that on his 8-track. He had an MX-5050, an Otari, and... basically, he was getting really busy with recording bands like Neutral Milk Hotel, not to drop names and stuff, and Bueller and all these bands that have gone on to be, you know, quite well known. But he just urged me to get my own 4-track, and I got my own 4-track. I got a TIAC A3440, brilliant little machine. I still have it. Actually, I have two now.
What does it record on, like a regular cassette tape or like?
No, it's quarter inch.
Okay.
And it's 15 IPS. So, okay. Okay. You know, but it's a good machine. It's really solid. Not a lot of noise. It's just a brilliant machine. I mean, really solid, really solid. But to be honest, I don't do an awful lot of ping-ponging and that kind of stuff. I try to sort of keep it simple, and it's probably because I learned very simple steps and just kind of stayed with them.
Right.
You know.
So what was your first single? What was your first 7-inch?
Our first single was called Build, and it came out on the Elephant Six imprint in 1996. And we recorded it in late 95. And it was basically, it was mostly just me and Robert from the Apples. Robert wanted, I think at first he kind of wanted to be a part of the band. He just wanted to write with me. And I was fine with that. And then I kind of got the bug to start a band. And my ex-wife, Rebecca Cole, ended up playing in the band. She ended up playing drums, and so I put a band together around that. But, yeah, Build, there was 3 songs on it. They're all very basic pop songs.
Can you still buy that?
I don't know. I think it's out of print.
Okay.
I don't know. I mean, once in a while you can... I have seen it on eBay,
yeah.
You know, once in a while. Maybe, I'm sure.
Do you have a copy of it?
I have a few. I have a couple, yeah.
Okay, interesting.
I kept them.
And how many, how did it progress from that? Like, how often were you putting out a single?
I wanted to keep us busy, so we followed that up that same year with Paper Plane, which there was my first, my own recording. So, you know, we did the first one on 8-track at Robert's studio, Pet Sound Studio in Denver, and then in my basement, I started experimenting around with the A3440, and did 3 more songs. And, you know, the pitch and the recording quality was a little brittle, but it's really interesting. It kind of yielded some really cool sort of experiments, and it kind of started to form our sound. And then the next year, we put out 1 more single, and that was on a Japanese label called, I think it was 1000 Guitar Mania, and they were putting out a lot of indie bands at that time. And we were sort of part of this sort of kind of hip little crowd, you know, this recording crowd. And so they put that out. And then we did 1 more, I think, like the next year, I think in 98 or 99, on an English label, Earworm. And that was Rider's Rain. So we have a lot of 7-inches now. I think we've got something like 7 or 8. We've mm-hmm. done a few, you know, but yeah, I like that format because, in fact, I mean, 7-inches, and I don't mean to digress too much, but 7-inches, you know, they are a project within themselves. They're like, you know, they're an EP mm-hmm. in a sense. There's only 3 songs. You can squeeze more than 3 songs. I just always would go with A side being the, you know, being the 1 song, and B side split that with 2 songs. And, basically, I liked the idea of compiling the 7 inches to make like a collection.
Right.
And there was a lot of that. I mean, still is a lot of that going on. Like, I remember, like, collecting, records where bands were sort of compiling their early 7 inches or EPs and stuff, you know. I remember Bell and Sebastian had, compendium of, or collection of their 12-inch singles.
Right.
They were like EPs. Like, wait, no.
Yeah, that was big in the 80s and early 90s, doing 12 inches that were basically singles.
Yeah.
They have like three tracks on them, like a 7-inch, but they'd sound better because the grooves are wider. You know?
So Dog on Wheels? Dog on, what's that one EP? And then there's the other one, La Pastille de la Bourgeoisie, I can't remember, but those...
Of Bell and Sebastian.
Yeah. And they had albums, but those were sort of mini albums, sorry.
Yeah. Well, what you were saying about they seem like their own mini project doing a 7-inch, and a lot of times those were like three songs, maybe four songs, that, you know, you don't, a 7-inch stopped becoming a single at some point, and it was just kind of like cheaper to record on, and it's a record. So, and then you... I love compilations of that stuff because it's so eclectic, whereas it seems like mentally as a band, if you're going in and you're going to record 14 tracks or something, that you think about that a different way. Like you've got a big goal there, whereas like a three-track thing or something, it's like that's feasible to do that whole project in a day or something. You
well,
know?
It's so fun. Like, you know, it's a lot of fun. I really enjoyed it. It was like an art project. Like I would do the covers...
Yeah,
I would write the liner notes. Everything was awesome. Well, I still do it. I'm still thinking of. I just put out something on Bandcamp last year, and that was the same kind of thing. I drew a cover for it, and yeah, in fact, I love the idea of, you know. At first, I mean, I would say a few years ago, I was kind of hostile to the idea of downloads and just really, I don't know, the whole digital realm seemed to encroach on. You know, the real art project-like sort of world of vinyl and sleeves and all that stuff. And it just, I started to get kind of hateful towards it. You know,
right.
I remember when it started to really move in. And then, you know, last year when I did the Bandcamp thing, I had a lot of fun with it and, you know, playing around with my Bandcamp page. And it was much the same kind of thing. It was actually cleaner. In some ways, it was more rewarding because the actual sort of... It was instantly gratifying, I think, more so than maybe waiting for your printed copy to come back from the shop.
Basically, when you're done, it's effectively
there.
Up there
it's
instantly.
Right there. And, you know, you're communicating with people immediately, and there's an immediate sort of... I mean, I'm not... Don't get me wrong. I'm not entirely full-on digital man, but I'm embracing it slowly, and I can see those sides of art and the digital realm, especially in music anyway, I mean, I think are really valid and very good.
Do you think that's some... Well, like, when's the last time you put out a 7-inch? However you want to define that.
Last time we did a 7-inch. Early aughts now. It's been a while.
Okay.
Because we did that with...
Like you would say 10 years ago, perhaps?
About 10 years ago. We did it with Omnibus in Sacramento.
Why? I'm just curious what your reasoning is for not having put out a 7-inch, because I know you've put out records in that time.
Yeah, no, I have. We slowed down a bit.
Yeah.
You know, I mean...
Do you think the format still has... There's still a place for those 7-inches with, like, three tracks on them?
Yes.
Projects
I would
like
totally,
that?
I'm thinking of doing something like that again.
Yeah.
It's really... For me, it's a matter of... Well, for me, it's finances. I'm getting someone either... I mean, you know, it used to be quite easy just to hand someone... Someone would call you up and say, hey, I want to do a 7-inch. And, you know, if I had the available material, the material available, I would, you know, of course, send it off on Dad or whatever, a CD, and they would go ahead and take care of it. We're not really in that position anymore. We haven't done anything for a while.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't released anything, like, officially, like a full-length record for at least 6 years. And I've been kind of just struggling a little bit, you know. I mean, I went through some personal sort of setbacks of the last 6 years, and so for the last 6 years I've been spending time picking myself up and also creatively picking myself up. You know, I think I got in a bit of a rut too, you know, and that happens to people. Your focus has shifted, and but yeah, I've just started working on new stuff now, and yeah, I'd totally still do a 7-inch. I mean, sure. Even if it was just like 100 or 200 copies, you know.
Yeah.
A few years ago, I was looking into trying to find out if it was possible to have your own, you know, purchase your own lathe, if there were any of those kicking about, but of course they're not.
Yeah.
I mean, I heard that, like, you know, Dead Moon has their own lathe that they cut their own records. I think that's awesome.
Yeah, that's rarer than the tape decks you're recording on,
yeah,
probably at this point. Is that true? Are the tape decks like a hassle?
Have become a hassle.
Do you record at home right now, or are you recording in a studio?
Well, the recording I'm making, we're making a new Minders record, and I've had quite a few people, different people play on it. I'm recording at Jackpot with Larry Crane, and it's not entirely a fully digital recording. The basic tracks were recorded on 2-inch tape, and then bounce to Pro Tools. So you've still got the warmth, and there's a bit of hiss too at the beginning of
both desirable
recordings.
Qualities.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I personally, I could live without it. I don't really care anymore, but at the same time, it still seems to be the best medium if you want really good punchy drums, and just has kind of more of a mechanical feel to it. But yes, I still record at home. I've been doing demos for the record, and some of those demos will probably end up being like, there's a lot of stuff I've written that won't make it on the record, so that will probably either end up as being B-sides or, I don't know, maybe even 7-inch or something like that. But yeah, I have a 1/2-inch, I have a 1/4-inch, and I have a 2-inch machine. The 2-inch is in the closet right now. It's kind of there's a couple of problems that you know, mechanical things. One of the biggest problems I've been facing with tape decks is transport issues, that meaning the actual machine, the motors that turn the reels, that kind of stuff. The pinch rollers, they rubberize over time, and so, you know, it's a matter of finding the right manufacturer, and those places are becoming, those vendors are becoming few and far between. So, yeah, it's a dying art. A lot of people, there's a handful of people that still record on tape. I record on tape, but I think at some point I'd probably go from fully digital.
Is there a... is there a time you're thinking of doing that? Would you consider like a Pro Tools setup or something like that, just for doing demos at home and stuff?
Yeah, I'd like to get a good Pro Tools setup, and I'd also like to improve some of my outboard gear. I'd like to mix and match. I'd like to be able to have both, so use tape and, you know, mixed media, just the way that we've been doing at Jackpot.
Yeah.
Yeah, I see. I mean, it's just so much easier. I mean,
yeah.
I've been watching it. I'm not a stranger to that. I mean, we've recorded on Pro Tools before, like years ago. You know, we kind of followed it all the way from the very beginning. I mean, we've been recording for a long time, and so you see all the changes. And I'd thought about that years ago, like maybe even like nearly 20 years ago. Like, well, this is obviously happening now. I never liked ADAT. I thought that format was kind of sucked. But the inroads that they've made with the technology now and Pro Tools, the plugins and all that stuff, sounds amazing. Yeah.
Yeah. The thing that I always enjoyed so much about pure digital recording was that it felt like you, in a way that you couldn't with like analog recording, you could have like the equivalent of dailies, like in film, like where you could just like, oh, well, before you turn off all the lights, like do a quick bounce, and then it's up on a website where you can just listen to it, or you could bounce right to your iPod or whatever.
Right.
And then it's like you're out walking that day, just like throw that in a mix with some other things so you can see like, how am I feeling about this? How's it sounding in the car? How's it sounding, you know? Like,
right.
That's crazy. Like, you think, like, well, I'm sure that, like, big bands had someone in the studio whose job was to do that. But to be able to do that, like, in your own little basement, like, oh, I'm just going to bounce this so I could just take it upstairs and play it on the stereo there. It's like, is that not kind of cool?
Yeah, it's great. Yeah, I mean, it's so much more, I mean, everything, there's a, I mean, a massive convenience now, you know? I mean, yeah. It's so much easier. It's easier to record generally.
You know who would have fucking loved digital recording is John Lennon. He was so into, like, the immediacy. Like, he wanted to record a song that was a political statement, and he wanted it, like, on the damn radio, like, fucking today, because it's about current events, you know? Right. Like, by the time, like, Power to the People made it to the airwaves, even back then, the time span was short. Like, you'd read about the Beatles recording a song, and then, like, 7 days later, it's, like, in the store. Like, what?
Yeah.
Are you kidding me?
I feel that's probably an accurate statement. I mean, I think he would probably fully embrace the digital age. Probably.
Well, also because he didn't care as much about quality. He cared about immediacy. He was right. Like, he was ahead of his time in terms of, like, what he wanted out of music, I feel like.
He used it as a form of communication. It was very much, exactly. You know, it was...
His newspaper.
Pamphleteering. I suppose you could probably argue that his art form then was probably... more involved in communication of art, and I mean, I guess that is the basic premise of most art anyway, to communicate. But it was definitely more of an immediacy to that. But yeah,
is there an equivalent to that when you're recording analog to just doing a quick bounce? Is that something that is that actually a solved problem that I'm just not aware of?
Balancing or bouncing and
well, it just seems like in digital recording you can have, like, a little virtual effects rack for quick mastering,
right?
That just sits in there. You just turn it off while you're recording, and then you turn it on and you do a bounce, and it's like, you know, you can do all those limiting things and make it sound like, you know.
Well, I mean, there are even, like, everything is, you know, there's a memory to digital recording that way. You know, you can go into your plugins and the setup is already
right,
and it can go straight back to that.
Right, because I remember going in your studio and you'd take a Polaroid snapshot of where the faders are. You know,
that's right. Yeah, analog recording with old equipment. Yeah, it's.
I think people should. Have you used Instagram? Do you know what that is?
Yeah, yeah.
I think people should Instagram their fader setups. You know, recording artists.
I mean,
how cool would that be? Like, I wonder what song they're recording.
Yeah, the old way of recording is pretty clunky. There is, you know, there's a certain amount of mystique to it, though, that I really love the tactile sort of sense of being able to touch things, turn knobs, hear things click into place, reel things up, you know, hear things whir and you know, fire up and slow down and. You know, I like the mechanical side of that too.
And counterintuitively, I think the limitations are actually help creativity.
Yes.
Like when you're like, well, I can't run another cable over here. I don't have one with me. So what are we gonna do? You know, right. I don't have another track. I can't just click a button and add a track like I can on my digital setup. You know,
it's true. We grew that way too. I mean, I grew that way as a writer too. You didn't have a soft option. Mm-hmm. With a four track, you know, you're pretty limited, and so right. your arrangements became, or at least I would say my arrangements became pretty savvy, or they just became.
You write songs differently or record them differently because you are planning ahead that way.
Right.
Like, guess what? You're going to have to play a tambourine right here next to.
Right.
You know, don't have the track. Sorry.
I mean, gosh, I mean, I remember talking about this to Robert from Robert Schneider. Who, in my mind, is like, I mean, he'd figured out some sort of genius formula with the four track.
Right.
He kind of shared it with, he shared a lot of his ideas with me, but, you know, I didn't want to seem like I was stealing his ideas, and I kind of wanted to do my own thing anyway. But he really had a system of placement, and he got really quite good at, you know, doing multi-tracking. We're talking a lot of tracks. With only four channels, so a lot of ping-ponging.
Yeah.
But his placement, so he would think in almost like formulaic way
yeah.
of how to what to record first And it was really quite brilliant. I mean, he kind of had it
kind of to compensate
out.
For like generation loss when you're bouncing.
Exactly.
That kind of thing. Yeah.
Yeah, you'd think about that. He would also think about, you know, with that generation loss, what's going to be placed there to sort of hide that a little bit, yeah. You know, all that stuff. I mean, yeah. It was really quite clever. I mean, you really, that helps you when you come to Pro Tools and how you sort of, I mean, it's all about less is more anyway. I mean, you got to figure, unless you want to be a Phil Spector, you know, mostly recording and writing and anything you do is it's mostly what, in the recording sense, what a song needs. If it doesn't need all that clutter, then don't put it there. Yeah. Anyway.
Do you... taking a step back, talking about music... well, we're talking about music, aren't we?
Recording.
Yeah. But by the way, you can swear on here. I don't know if you noticed.
I haven't.
I'm just letting yet. You know. Just so you let your guard down. You know.
I think I was just testing myself to see how long I could.
I forgot to tell you ahead of time. I always forget to tell people, and then I'll start swearing, and then be like, "Oh, so I can swear."
Right.
When you're recording, is there another artist or musical style or style of a recording engineer or producer that you have in your head that you're trying to shoot for or feeling inspired by?
You know, I don't know that much about. I mean, I've read books, sure, on Abbey Road and you know, some of the classic studios like Capitol Studios in L.A. The Nashville Sound and Memphis, you know, Chess Records. I've read a little bit about that, but my knowledge is actually kind of a bit limited in that area. Funnily enough, I mean, you'd think, well, someone who records would avidly read stuff about recording, but I think I got put off about, you know, with that. I was so ready to record, and I was afraid that if I got, you know, I started getting wrapped up in reading about recording, that would put me off. Because, I mean, there's people that would, you know, put more or less poo-poo my idea of, like, recording my own band and all that stuff. Oh, you should just have a professional do that kind of stuff. And so I never really sort of kind of read up so much on that. But sounds... I know what I like. I know what the sounds, you know, the sounds that I'm looking for. I have been interested in, recently anyway, going right back to where we started and also going back to real primal basic recordings. I don't know. I've been listening to a lot of country music, a lot of country and western from, you know, the mid-50s onwards, and really enjoy... I mean, actually, those are... I don't know if you could really call those primitive. Some of them are primitive recordings, but some of them are just... I mean, I don't really know how they got those sounds. I mean, they're not using an awful lot of equipment, but they got these huge sounds, and I don't know.
I had this Chet Atkins compilation that goes back to...
Right.
Fairly early. Just... It's amazing stuff, like the sound, that guitar sound, and it's just him finger picking with, you know, probably the worst, you know, oldest pickup you can imagine.
Well, I mean, he was a technician. He was a great musician.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. I think back then, the folks that ran the studios, well, they're technicians today, but they were even more so. They were men in white coats, you know, lab coats. There's a book that is at Larry Crane's studio. It's the Beatles recording book or whatever, and it's actually just about Abbey Road and all the equipment in detail. Like, I don't know, have you seen that book?
No, but I would love to read that book.
So the flying fader boards, the desks, the sound desks, the machines, the microphones, everything. I mean, everything's in this book. It's not about the Beatles. It's about EMI.
Yeah,
Abbey Road, yeah, now I pay more attention to that stuff. I think I was in a bit of a hurry, you know, I was afraid. I mean, even though, you know, I listen to our recordings now, they just sound like, you know, someone learning how to record. But I wanted to just say, I felt like if I just pressed record and we played, we would capture something that would be totally us, unique, our sound, you know. In a sense, I mean, kind of is, but I mean, it wasn't that unique. And I don't know, I just, I wanted to kind of live in a little bubble world, record and learn that way. Obviously getting, you know, tips and tricks along the way, but sort of, I guess, learn organically. Now I'm probably a little more sort of, I don't know, what's the word? Not scientific, but a little more methodical, I suppose, yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel like... What's the biggest difference when you listen to like an old recording? Do you feel like, oh, the drums sound like shit, and now I'm nailing them? Or like, is there something musically that's like really just jumps out at you? Like, what's the most horrible thing you hear on those old recordings where you're like, well, I would never do that now? Just an obvious mistake.
I think probably the performances.
Good answer.
So sometimes though, sometimes it's like, I can't believe we did that. That was pretty cool. And that's perfectly, it's perfect, you know?
Yeah.
And I couldn't have done it better. Like now I've tried to re-record things. Well, we were recording, the last time I was in about a month ago, and we were doing some recording of basic tracks, and Larry had played, he was playing Jeff Lynne, you know, from the Electric Light Orchestra. He had gone out and re-recorded all of his great hits. Do you know about this?
No.
He's re-recorded all of the big hits of the 70s, like Mr. Blue Sky.
Like, and, you mean with a current band? Like,
no,
new?
Just him. He recorded, re-recorded everything.
Okay.
And he pretty much sound exactly the same.
I'm not surprised by that at all. It's crazy.
And it's crazy.
Does he play like... He doesn't play strings. What does he do for the strings?
No, the strings, I mean... from what I remember, there aren't that many strings.
Okay.
There's, I mean, like, he did everything from Showdown...
Oh,
Mr.
Man.
Blue Sky.
Really? That's
yeah,
crazy.
You should check it out.
I will, definitely.
I mean, it's it's pretty interesting. So when you hear that stuff now on commercials, because he's getting a lot of commercial play...
He is.
Those aren't the original recordings. Those are the ones he did last year. Yeah, it's pretty intense. I mean, I was listening to it, and it's really quite amazing. I mean, he is an incredible musician. His performances, I mean, it's almost savant like. You know, it's strange how he
reminds me of Paul McCartney, like in terms of his whole like the way he approaches music. Because Paul always seemed the same way too. Like he'd wait till everyone was out of the studio and then like, fuck it, just re-record the drums myself.
Right.
You know, like, well, I don't give a shit. I'll play everything, you know, and that seems like I, you know.
Well, yeah, there are...
He's like Jeff Lynne. Like, he knew exactly what sound he wanted from every instrument, and if necessary, he would play it.
There's an interview in the new tape op, or
okay.
I think, and he interviews Jeff Lynne.
And, Larry Crane does?
Yeah, he does.
Really? Okay, so for everyone listening out there, we'll put a link in the show notes, but Tape Op is an amazing magazine. I mean, if you are recording at home, you're reading this magazine. It's like, it's the only one there is, right?
Right. Well, I mean in that
brilliant.
Depth.
I mean they've interviewed, like, you know, Jeff Emmerich on there and, like, everyone.
Mm-hmm.
That's such a great magazine. Wow. So did Larry Crane have something to do with Jeff Lynne's recordings, or
no.
just interviewed him?
He just interviewed him for the magazine, and... It was revealing, because I remember reading the liner notes. If there was one thing, you know, when I was a kid, I'd read liner notes of records.
Yeah.
And in those days, you know, a lot of these guys would, these big bands would list all the equipment they used.
Yeah.
You know, right down to how many hours of recording, you know, and the mixing and all that kind of stuff. And Jeff Lynne was, he especially did that on, like, I think on the gatefold of Out of the Blue, which is their 1977 record. There's a pretty in-depth sort of list of equipment. But he just went into all of that, the whole process in an interview. I mean, as much as there wasn't that much time in the interview, it seemed like, but, like, he really kind of, he shared some secrets, you know, the way he records. It was pretty fantastic. It was, I mean, he has a studio at home. I mean, he just spent, he mentioned this. He really, he was a recorder, and, you know, he preferred recording music to performing music in live. And that makes sense.
Right.
But yeah, you should read the article. It's really, if you like that band and you like that brand of pop, I would check it out.
I do like that brand of pop. I was on the first episode of our podcast, I talked about how I'm really into the some 1975 era Bee Gees album right now. It's the one with like Jive Talkin',
oh, yeah,
and you know, Nights on Broadway. I mean, it is a great album, but yeah, it's like I get a lot of shit about it.
Those guys were great writers.
But, I mean, a lot of ways, I think a lot of the studios were like at their apex in that era, and those recordings. I mean, the same with like Stones in the 70s. Those recordings, they sound like they know what they're doing. They're just going right through, you know, nailed it. Like one day, you know, they record all these songs in like an afternoon, and they just sound great. Like the drum sound is so good. It's just such a warm sound, you know.
There's a good documentary that just came out on HBO. It's another Stones documentary, because I think Scorsese put one out, what, last year or the year before?
Shine a Light.
And then there's another one that just came out around the holidays, around Christmas time. And I think it's more of a Rolling Stones.
What is the subject? Is it a general Stones?
Well, they actually talk about Exile on Main Street a bit.
Okay.
Which I found interesting. I already knew a little bit about Exile on Main Street, but they spent a lot of time on making that record, and it wasn't a very smooth.
A lot of vintage footage of them?
Yeah, there's footage.
I totally saw that documentary. Yeah. It was basically about that album. I don't remember what it was called, but that was amazing. It was so good. Like, they'd have their kids down there.
Right.
Someone on the other side of the room is, like, doing heroin. You know?
Right.
Like,
I mean,
they're just hanging out in some castle in France.
Keith Richards was going through, like, the height of his, you know, his usage there.
And, yeah.
But, I mean, that entire experience, well, they were tax exiles. They had to leave England because they were broke. And so they moved to the south of France. Recorded the record in the subterranean sort of basement, you know, in Keith Richards' basement of his mansion that he had. I don't know if he had bought it or rented it. And man, I mean, that is their magnum opus. That's their greatest record.
Yeah,
you know, I mean, it's so live, it's so real, it's a living record. But
we have that here. It's nice. And, you know, it's funny because it has such a visual style. I don't know if Warhol did that album, but...
Oh, yeah.
And that's, you know, it's just like it's kind of scattered, roughly laid out black and white photographs, but they carry that style through the two liners that are like full color, you know.
It's
like
a difficult cover to look at.
It is. It's
a real difficult one.
It doesn't have a subject. It's just kind of like
there's some images in there at the very, you know, that are hard to look at too, though. I mean, the cover itself is just the subject matter, and I think you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah.
But it's I know that they were going for a certain thing.
Right. Right. Yeah. Personally, I prefer the Sticky Fingers cover. You know, that's just me. You know. Did you ever see that letter from Mick to Andy Warhol about the cover that like went out on the internet a year or two back? I'll put that in the show notes as well. But it was basically like, you know, hey, basically saying, you know, Andy, you know, so you have the okay to make the album cover. You know, just don't do anything like weird with any weird textures, because that'll like damage records and stuff. So Warhol comes back. Like, that was just, that letter went out. But it was like, you know, a brief thing from Mick Jagger. And, of course, Warhol came back with the albums with the zipper on the cover, which destroyed literally, like, half the records they ever printed. It was like, oh, great, you're putting a zipper record in a big stack. Like, that's going to go well. What could go wrong?
That's
so awesome.
Can I get a beer?
Of course you can get a beer. Yeah, I'll just talk right through it, you know. This is good. I'll come up with another question. Do you have a favorite Do you still buy vinyl?
All the time.
If there's a record on vinyl, you'll buy it on vinyl?
Yes.
Well, nowadays, you often don't have to make a choice because you'll buy the vinyl and it'll have a little download card in it, you know?
I have something to say about that. I remember I moved, as I said, we talked about this earlier on, I moved to the States in 84. And within like a couple of years, I remember I lived in this real suburban area of Colorado, Colorado Springs, pretty suburban. And they had a Sam Goody in the mall. And, you know, up until, I think it might have been 86 or 87, probably 1986, it was all vinyl. And then, you know, gradually the CDs crept in. And one day I went in there and all the albums were gone and it was all CDs. And I was shocked. And I remember really paying, I was looking at this new format. I mean, it wasn't new, but it was pretty new. And first off, one of the main reasons why I have such a vinyl fetish is it's just, you know, you have the cover, you have the format, that you have the beautiful the artwork, everything is, I don't know, again, it goes back to that art project. I mean, an album is a piece of art, and a CD is, I suppose, certain CDs, like if they're packaged well, can be considered art.
I think some of them got to that point, but really, for the first decade, at least, of their existence, a CD was this fucking awful plastic shell with a couple pieces of paper in it and a plastic shiny disc. And it was like, you look at it and you're like, it just radiates cheapness and plasticness.
Yeah, I was really, really disappointed. And there have been a few disappointments along the way in the music biz, and that was probably the first really big one. And I was so I just didn't know what to do. It's sort of similar to today with, and you know, this is probably me griping a little bit, but I get really freaked out by these, you know, Nooks and all the stuff. You know, the electronic books. I love buying books. I love collecting things. I'm a collector. Obviously, not everybody is, and that makes sense. I mean, but I love having something in my hand. Again, it goes back to sort of just having, you know, more just the experience of something real. Yes, to get back to your original question, I always buy vinyl first. Now, once in a while, I still buy CDs. I just bought some CDs the other day. But I picked up like a Bob Marley record last week. I'm always like hitting.
Which one did you pick up?
It was, I'll think of it in a minute. It's 1970. It's.
Okay. Something with the bus, the tour one, is it?
No, it's. I think it's a reissue because it just has him on the cover. It's a live shot of him.
Okay.
But it's. I'll think of it in a second.
Okay, sure.
I'm having a brain fart right now, but it's got it has Mr. Brown on it. It's got
Mr. Brown writes the tune.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Okay. Oh wow. Didn't Lee Perry produce that one?
Yes, it's produced by Lee Perry.
Oh,
it's really great. I mean, it's fantastic. It's really
okay.
Soul Rebel.
Okay. Okay.
1970. Fantastic record.
Okay.
I was just really craving it. I don't know about you guys, this time of the year in Portland, I start to go a little crazy with the
weather, you
know,
sure, yeah.
And I'm starting to feel about, you know, think about sunshine and and joints and
of sunshine.
Yeah, really. I start dreaming about tropical islands and smoking big fat doobies and laying in the sun. So I can say that.
Hello,
right?
Here's Bob Marley.
Am I allowed that? I'm allowed that, right?
Of course. Yeah. Okay. So I think a lot of that has to do with just mobility. I think some people are predisposed; they want to move around and listen to their music and be on the go and not have to carry things and be able to read their book on their phone and stuff. And some people, Martin, might value being at home more, and that works if you have records. I feel the same way. Like I come here, but if I get a craving, I'm going to walk home from here, and it's going to take an hour, and I want to keep listening to my Bob Marley record, you know?
Right.
Yeah. So yeah.
Although, now
I think we've arrived at a great place if the records that we buy come with digital downloads. Because why should we have to choose? I mean, I'm paying for the record. The digital download is essentially free.
There's also something to be said about the format of the album, and
yes,
you know,
yeah,
there's sort of kind of a ritual, and I like that ritual with an album, getting right. home and rushing it onto the turntable. You know, like I was quite excited about this. You know, reggae records are really hard. I mean, not Bob Marley records per se, but like I've been looking for this Harry J. All-Stars record. It's just an instrumental record. I can't find it anywhere on vinyl. In fact, I've had a hard time finding it on CD too. I really love ska and reggae, early reggae, and yeah, I mean, gosh, that's really hard music to find on vinyl. And I found this record at Everyday Music last week, and rushed it home. And it was just like being a kid, you know, like it's the same experience.
Yeah.
Sure, pulling it up on my Pandora or my, you know, my iTunes or whatever. It's sort of the same thing, but I don't know. There's still a ritual. I think what I'm always trying to do is relive that ritual from when I was a kid.
Right.
I mean, there are little things, or I would say these days, very few things that give me as much excitement. You know, there's just something about it. There's a mystique and kind of a romance to it that I really enjoy, and yeah.
And that too, it seems like a lot of bands will take 5 years and they'll put something out that would have been a double LP. You know, it would have been they're All Things Must Pass or something, you know, in a box. But instead, that's just like their album, and that they took 5 years to make it. And it seemed like, you know, in mainstream music throughout the 70s and even really through the 80s, there was this sort of canonical album. And there'd be this sort of, it was recorded with a mental pause after 20 minutes. Like, there would be this cadence where it was just like, the side one might be one song,
right.
Or it might be 10 songs if it's, you know, the Minutemen or whatever, but it would sort of like, you even without it, when you get it on the CD, you'd know that's in the 80s. The CD is always, it was like, oh, I can still tell it's supposed to stop here. And then at some point it was like, no, it's just this, you know, 70 minute sequence of tracks. And, you know, sorted alphabetically, who cares? I mean, it didn't seem like it had that same.
I felt like in the 90s, there was sort of a new renaissance, mm-hmm. And a celebration of recording and making an album. Records got really long in the 90s. Like,
yeah.
They were really, you know, like, I'm trying to think of some records, but, you know, I remember looking, because I would look at times, constantly would look at the times of records, how long.
Yeah.
And, of course, we are a pop band, and, you know, I primarily wrote songs that were 2.5 minutes long. And yeah. So our first record was incredibly short.
Yeah.
It was like 27 minutes long.
Which would not, no one would have batted an eye in the 60s.
No, but in the 90s, in 1998, the record company was not pleased. Discount.
Yeah, exactly.
I felt like, well, it's ridiculous. What, you want 20 more songs on this thing? You know, I mean, it's just pop. You know, my ear drops off after a while. But to get back to my point, as far as, you know, recording was re-celebrated, I think, in the 90s. In the 80s, yeah, I think it kind of hit a wall. The 70s, I mean, you can look at ELP and, gosh, all of King Crimson, Frank Zappa, Captain Beefheart, all that stuff. I mean, the real experimental Eno stuff. I mean, wow, we really sort of went into a different universe. It really branched off into many different genres as far as pop music, rock and roll. And yeah, a lot of experimentation happened. I don't know where we are now. I mean, I don't know if that's a good segue to wherever we're going with this, but...
I have no idea. I definitely remember in terms of like album running time, there was a point in the, I guess, the late 90s when I could afford to and wanted to buy vinyl, but people were recording always, even if the band knew they were going to put out vinyl, they were still recording by an hour-long album or something. And you'd get the CD and you're just like, oh, you know, it's their CD release, whatever. It's always one CD. It fits on a CD. And then you'd be like, nah, I'd rather buy the vinyl. And it would be like this double record set. And right. It was like a big fucking deal. And it would be like $30 to $40 fucking dollars. Like, are you shitting me?
It's
$10 on CD. I'm not going to do this. This is insane. Like, guess what? I have to buy the CD.
Yeah.
You're going to bankrupt me with this record pricing. And now it seems to have kind of fallen back a little
bit.
It
has.
And, you know,
it's
ridiculous. Like 180 gram vinyl, like the thing would be thicker than the CD case, you know?
And to be honest, I mean, some of the, I think I was disappointed with the production of some of the records I would get that were on 180. It seemed like somewhere, you know, of course it was a heavy weight, but the mastering of the record had kind of been skimped or kind of compromised or whatever.
Like they'd forgotten that. Like the guy, you know, do you remember in the like especially in the 80s, but for a long time, people would have written things on the inside, like groove, between the grooves on the record?
Oh, I've done it. Yeah, I've done that.
That was such a thing, you know? Like it was just assumed like that was a reason to buy the record, partly. Was one of the reasons. Like there would be something that would be like a lyric from the, I remember so many bands, they'd write their own little couplet that would be like the A side, the B side. That would just be something there. You could pick up a record and odds are you'd see it there. And at some point I read there was one guy who mastered records in the UK who was responsible for like an inordinate number of them. Like the band would request something because they knew that he did it.
Right.
But you mean you've actually written it out, or you've provided words to go there on records?
Oh, wait, were you talking about actually scratching on the vinyl itself?
Yeah.
You have done that on I think on our first single.
You got to. How do you do that? You just
give
you a little
we mastered it, and when we mastered the mother plate, in Denver, we went to a lathe, a mastering studio, vinyl studio in Denver. And the guy had a lathe in his basement. And
that's kind of awesome.
He got to write on it. It was like
That's great.
It was just a heavy sort of needle kind of thing that you scratch in there.
Yeah.
Well, we put a lock groove on our second 7-inch. And
okay,
I remember
them
setting that up, which was kind of cool.
Yeah.
You know, and you can, when they cut record, you can kind of look through a microscope and see it being cut. And, you know, it's kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, that is, that's... It's funny how basic, like, records are the foundation of recording as we know it. It's like that was the first, you know, that's what recording was. It was sound waves etched onto a surface. You know, it's amazing how, like, it doesn't seem possible that digital music can surpass that. It can only match that, you know? I mean, it has an advantage in that it won't wear. It won't get scratched, but like the thing that comes off the record press, it's kind of hard to beat that.
Well, I've been collecting 78s, and
I saw that collection of yours. Yeah.
And some of the records I have are over 100 years old now. You know, and of course, those old, they're not vinyl records. They're what are they? They're acetate, right?
They're really hard.
They're really brittle. I should look up the material, but they're very brittle.
Put it in the show notes. We've got that.
Okay. They're real brittle material. So a lot of the times when you're thumbing through, going through these records in stores, and I mean, sort of more of the discerning record shops that still have 78s, they'll have them in a separate section, and you know, there's spaces so that the records don't get bunched up and smashed up against each other because they're very brittle and they shatter.
Mm-hmm.
But for the most part, I mean, it's quite amazing. Like, I've got a couple of Victrola machines, hand crank machines, and, you know, you get these the needles you just literally sort of screw into the head. There's like a tiny diaphragm that sort of just basically it's just a sound box. And that goes from the needle, the arm or the horn, to the box below. But the sound is incredible. I mean, it's really dynamic. You know, these recordings are fairly primitive. I mean, some of the stuff that gets into the 20s and the 30s, more of the foxtrot sort of, period, there's more dynamics kind of, obviously, on some of the records it says electrically recorded. So, I mean, the earlier stuff, like from the turn of the century, the last century, 1905 and 1908, you had orchestras just playing right into a horn. And then, you know, you went from there to electrically recording with a microphone, a very, you know, like a ribbon microphone or whatever. And again, I'm probably not describing this technically very, very accurately, but I'm often shocked at like how dynamic these recordings are, and they're priceless. They're timeless. And I don't know. I think vinyl's a great medium, a great archival medium. I think it's, I mean, it seems to have stood the test of time. The digital archival sort of format, I think the verdict's still out on that. I mean, as far as CDs, well, we've seen how CDs wear in time. I mean, I've got CDs that are over 25 years old now and stuff, and they're kind of, you know, they're wearing out. Can you resurface CDs and stuff? I mean,
you'd have to try to get what you can off of it and then right. put it in a non-physical digital format.
I mean, you can still burn, such a thing, yeah. You know, if you're able to reburn a CD or whatever, or just, yeah. Well, not even that, you just put it in MP3 format or whatever.
Yeah, just dump it to your computer.
Yeah.
Not even an MP3 if you care about the quality. I mean, you might want to just dump it into a Wave or something.
A Wave, okay. Yeah. And that I know less about, but...
So you're saying you have records that were recorded by a device placed in front of an orchestra in which it may have been powered by electricity, but essentially the sound conversion.
Well, I think those early recordings weren't electric.
Okay.
They were just
someone
entirely...
Someone cranked up the recording device.
Well, no, I think you probably had this large horn that at the end of that, in some way, there was like a lathe carving out, or I don't really quite know how they did it, but I mean, in 1905, I don't think the equipment was electrical. I mean, I think it was still entirely mechanical, the recording devices. I'm pretty sure. I'm pretty sure it was all hand cranked and like, this is pretty steampunk shit.
Yeah, it's pretty
shit.
Crazy. Yeah, it's steampunk, mean,
it's,
exactly.
It's
so
crazy.
There we go. Now we understand Martin Leeper.
Steampunk.
The whole point of this interview is to get to this point.
I don't know.
We got you to admit that you listen to music that has never even been touched by electricity. from production to consumption, no electricity.
I really get a thrill out of playing some of those records, and I've got, as I said, I got two Victrolas, and I love. Once in a while, I take them out in the yard and in the summer, and kick back. It is a bit of a process because
it is portable.
See? Totally portable.
See, haters.
You know, and it's just, there's something really, my neighbors once in a while have like sort of come over and listened, and there's just something about a mechanical music machine, you know, that nothing's plugged in and you're entirely sort of, I don't know, it's cool.
That's pretty crazy. Well, okay, it's been an hour. I've enjoyed our conversation.
Oh,
thanks so much for
likewise.
Stopping by.
Thanks for having me.
So that was Martin Leeper. I should add that after our spirited discussion, Martin played me a preview of his forthcoming CD, which sounds really amazing. I'm really excited. He would not allow me to air any of the tracks yet because they're not mixed or anything yet. My attempts to steal the CD were unsuccessful. But that'll be coming out later this year. He's been working with Larry Crane at Jackpot, and it's sounding pretty amazing. There's a really good group of people working on it. And then we spent the next few hours listening to Bee Gees and Beach Boys and talking about how...
Sounds like a dream evening for you.
It's really right in my wheelhouse. I'm sad that we didn't record like the whole 3-hour conversation, but That you heard hour one. Hour two was pretty much us talking about Beach Boys recordings and details, and then the rest was us talking more about Bee Gees and ELO and like lots of 70s stuff. So maybe some other day we'll have Martin back and we'll talk about even less interesting, more esoteric topics.
Does he have a preference with time periods for the Bee Gees, for instance? Like,
I think he was trying not to hurt my feelings, but I think he likes the 60s Bee Gees better, as do most people mm-hmm. these days. I like them fine, but I kind of been really hooked on the 70s. And then Beach Boys, I'm not sure that he'd heard the album that I played him, which was kind of exciting. It was the one that we talked about recently, Wild Honey. Mm.
That was on episode zero. So,
oh yeah. Oh,
sadly, well, these folk have not.
Yeah, we're gonna circle around back to that one for sure, or just play the recording of us talking about it. But yeah, Wild Honey is a good. And what it was interesting listening to it with Martin, who'd never heard it before, because what he pointed out was that the recordings are so minimal. Like, there's not even a hi-hat. I pointed out that I think it was Dennis. No, I think it was Carl who played drums for the Beach Boys. I don't even know. But he was such a bad drummer, I don't think he could handle more than like two things to hit. I don't think he could play that part. Because if you listen to older Beach Boys, and if you listen to like that album, I just don't like Pet Sounds. They had a whole crew in the studio, the Wrecking Crew, which we also talked about. I'm just gonna have to get Martin back in, and we're gonna have to do like a three person debate about which Beach Boys album is superior. I mean, there's Pet Sounds, sure, but they're all.
Do people make arguments against Pet Sounds? I feel like even if they like something else, they're like, well, the Pet Sounds.
I think that more the argument you'd make is that it's the Pet Sounds isn't the Beach Boys. Mm. I think the Beach Boys would make that argument. Except for Brian, that it wasn't the Beach Boys. They did the vocals, but they were almost more like session musicians themselves on their own record. I think that was why that was such a contentious contentious album. Well, on that note, we'll see you next week. Thanks for listening.